No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Or you can Skype us at BBSRADIOONE. Tonight, we have a special show, a dedication to 9/11. Today's 9/11. It's the 15th anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And we're lucky enough to have with us Kathleen Gomez, who's an old friend of the show and one of my oldest and dearest friends, who was in New York during the attacks. I was here in Washington and remember quite clearly the attacks on the Pentagon. But Kathleen was right at ground zero almost, living in Murray Hill at the time. And she's been nice enough to join us and so that we can remember this day. And before we start, let me just give you a brief rundown. 2,977 people were killed and 6,000 were injured, including 2,606 people at the World Trade Center and 125 at the Pentagon. And that's the most ever in an attack on the United States. It's more people than were killed at Pearl Harbor. So it's really the greatest, most devastating attack on American soil probably since Gettysburg. It was the second attack. Sometimes people forget that, but it was the second attack on the World Trade Center. World Trade Center had been attacked earlier with a car bomb, and maybe Kathleen can correct me. I don't remember if anybody was killed in that attack.
I think there might have been one or two because it was underneath the, in the garage of the, underneath where the windows of the world were. But it was nothing that was, I mean, it was scary, but it was nothing that was tremendous. You know, maybe there might have been one or two killed. I'm not sure. I can't remember. I just remember it being a big deal because it did talk a lot about the guys had rented a U-Haul or somebody had taken it through the tunnel and parked it underneath there when it happened. And no one ever would envision, you know, kind of after that, kind of thought it was invincible, that nobody could bring the towers down.
Well, I remember thinking to myself when it happened, and I was watching on TV, I remember thinking to myself, you know, isn't this a tragic accident of some sort? You know, when they showed the flight path of the planes going down the Hudson River, and I said to myself, some poor pilot just got lost somehow or had a heart attack or we're going to find out, you know. And I remember very distinctly as I was thinking that, then the other plane hit the other tower. And you saw it right there on TV while they were showing the one tower smoking. Then the other plane hit the other tower, and you're like, oh, my God. This is an attack. This is on purpose. And even when I heard about the Pentagon, again, I felt the same thing. I said, oh, people are just hysterical. This has happened in New York, but, you know, it hasn't happened. You know, the Pentagon thing, that they're just, people are just you know, getting hysterical here. And then, of course, we found out that was true, and Shanksville, Pennsylvania was true as well, where they were supposedly going to attack the Capitol.
Well,
so it was a terrible day. And do me a favor, Kathleen, tell us about it, because you were there.
It's kind of very strange, because today was probably one of the first anniversaries of 9/11 where it reminded me so much of that day, because it's just here in Kansas City, a perfect day, which was what it was like in New York. And you know, when you have those days in the city where you can't feel the smog, it's the perfect temperature, everybody is in a good mood, the taxi drivers aren't yelling at you, nobody's really honking, everyone is just like out in the streets. I took Diego, who was 7, to, I guess he was in first or second grade, I'm trying to remember. And I dropped him off, and I remember coming back and, you know, seeing everyone in the neighborhood. The guy who owns the coffee shop was out sweeping, you know, the sidewalk. You know, the woman who owned the dry cleaning store was out. She was sweeping. I mean, everybody wanted to be outside because the weather was so beautiful. And everyone was happy and friendly. And I remember a bunch of us were going to go down. I had Mateo, and he was just going to be 2 in October. So a bunch of us were going to go down. We always went down to the American Express building because they had put in an incredible playground site, you know. So we'd take the bus, we'd get on the, you know, the subway and go down there and spend the day. And because it was so beautiful, we decided that we were going to, you know, take the young ones, and then we'd come back in time to pick up our older kids. So I was upstairs, and there had been all this controversy about these helicopters that, you know, do all these tour guides, right, and how close they come to everything. And all of a sudden, about 9:30, I remember it was like you just got this feeling that something's going on. And then the boy's father's Bill called me. He goes into New Jersey, and he was headed across 34th Street. He says, you know, I don't know what's going on. Something's happening, he said, and everything stopped. Everything. Like, it's almost as when it hit that tower, like time froze. People stopped. It's a very strange critical mass kind of thing that happened. And I remember called me, he says, I'm just going to come back because everything's shut down, they're not letting anyone do anything, and I have a chance to turn around and come back. It's okay. And then a couple of people who, you know, we were going to go down and to the American Express building, she called me and said, you know, there's somebody hit the World Trade Center. I said, what? You know, those helicopters? We all thought it was a helicopter. And then someone said, turn on the TV, and then that's when we saw it. Now, it's really bizarre to think this way, but King Kong was being filmed at the same time. And all of us were thinking, like, is this some incredible stunt that's going to be played? Because they had been doing all this publicity about King Kong. It was going to be just crazy, and the visuals were going to be unbelievable. And because you just couldn't fathom, you couldn't wrap your head around the idea that this was a terrorist attack. It had to be something else. You know, there just had to be, you know. And so at that time, we had a lot of people who worked, they were like, you know, from home. And you had this incredible, I mean, I was with Mateo, all of a sudden you wanted to go outside. It's like you didn't want to be in there by yourself, you wanted to see what's going on. All of us came out of the apartment, and we went up to the rooftop. I'm on the 5th, went up to the rooftop, and had clear vision of the towers. And we were seeing the smoke, and, you know, everybody then at that point was on top of the roof decks of the building. And there was a couple of really tall ones on the corner of my block. And then we had, like, mine was a 6th-floor apartment building. There were smaller ones. But you could see everyone up there. And we were all watching it. And one of the neighbors, she worked down. She was, I think, on the 85th floor. And she decided to take a mental health day. So she was like, oh, my gosh. Like, she was so torn. She wanted to run down there to help her friends. But she knew she couldn't. She felt so guilty that she had taken that day off, but so glad she had, you know. She was crying. I mean, it was such a sense of helplessness, and we were all over there. And when we saw them fall, yeah, I'll never, ever forget, because it seemed like the whole city just did, at the same time they went, you know, like, you could hear it. It was the biggest sound I'd ever heard, and it was from everyone on the rooftops. We were just... And then you just didn't want to, you wanted to run down there. You wanted to do something. So we had gotten these messages from the school that if we needed to leave the kids in the school, they weren't going to let them know what happened. They were going to keep the kids in the public school, which was only a block away. by that time, everyone was just going crazy, and we were trying to watch the news. We were up on the rooftops, and then I remember we all just kind of went to the streets. We went to the streets to see what we could do as people. And this, it all blurs together. But probably within an hour and a half or two that the buildings fell, you started to see people, because you either went north or you went south. You went over the Brooklyn Bridge to living in Brooklyn in that area, or boats were taking people over to New Jersey, and then you walked up north, like from lower Manhattan up to, say, towards the Bronx or up towards Midtown or, the Upper East Side or West Side. And everyone looked the same. You couldn't tell who was African-American or Indian or white or Mexican, because everyone had the same color, and that was ash. And I remember everyone was getting ready, because where I lived on 30th Street was in between between Lexington and 3rd, and on 28th and Lexington was where the Armory, and that's where everyone was going to register the missing, the people who they knew worked there and they hadn't heard anything from. And then on 30th and 1st, which was three or four blocks over, was Bellevue, which is where they were going to be taking a lot of people at Bellevue and at St. Vincent's. And so people went down there lining up to give blood. I mean, we had an expectation of many survivors and lots of people coming. So, they were, go down, give your blood, all this. The people rushed to the hospitals. And there was just so few that came. I mean, what ended up having Bellevue was a place where you could go and they were finding pieces of people and, through forensics, trying to identify them. But in between those blocks, people were putting up pictures on anything, on the buildings, on everywhere, saying, have you seen him? Do you know? Because a lot of the hope was, well, there's no communication. There's everything stopped. There's not a bus. There's not a subway. There's not a taxi. Nothing is, mechanical is moving. Maybe they're just taking their time, or somebody brought him into the apartment, and they just can't get back to us. I mean, there was that belief the next day and the next day. So there were thousands, it seemed, of pictures of people, it seemed mostly in their 20s and 30s and 40s, and pictures of them at their weddings, at their bar mitzvahs, at their graduations, at bachelor parties. And all of these pictures showed incredible people. I mean, you know how when you look at a picture and you just see nice people and you think, ah, that guy or that girl, it really seemed like they'd be nice, I mean, that's what it was. And people were just sitting after about the fourth day, people were sitting there realizing it wasn't going to happen. And I remember that they tell me it was like in Beirut, when Beirut was bombed, and people were just out on the sidewalks, drinking water, trying to keep some sense of civilization going. And I think the one thing that I felt from that point in time was that I've never been in a place where so many people pulled together. I mean, people were on the streets with food, with water, with shoes, because amazingly, there were so many people who had lost their shoes through this. So they were walking barefoot, and some bleeding, and they were in total shock. So people were bringing out chairs to have people sit down. They were, sponging them off and giving them water and giving them food and saying, who do you need just to call? And it was like everywhere you saw somebody, people were hugging each other, because it was like, we will overcome this. Now, the smell for days was terrible. It had gone across the river to like Brooklyn. But when you burn the handle of a pan that melts, the plastic. Yeah. When the wind shifted, and I came back up going towards north of Manhattan, the smell of death and that plastic was unbelievable. And I remember for us, my babysitter was an older woman, and her daughter worked down in the World Trade Center. And her daughter really never worked after that. She had gotten there a little bit late and had hit the plaza or the entrance to go in as the first airplane hit. And from what I understood, she was not in the building, but she was far, kind of away. It's a plaza, and she froze. And she sat there. I guess she must have stood not knowing what to do. And then she saw some people who had jumped. And they hit in front of her. And as a man, because they didn't talk about all the jumpers that there were. There were a lot of jumpers. Because, you know, you had the observation tower on the very top. You had all these people who could not get the towers becoming infernos. They had a choice. Do you burn or do you jump from 85 whatever stories? And the theory, I guess, the mom told me, you know, you're supposed to, people think you die, you pass out or something before you hit. For her, she felt that she saw everyone, that somehow they stopped in time. She saw their face before, you know, when you hit, it's just gone, you know. And as she was watching this, a man who was standing closer to her got sliced in half by falling glass, because that's the other thing, you know. So she became very traumatized and never, I believe, ever worked. You know, I lost touch with I think her name was Pat. It was Pat. She passed away, but her daughter, from what I remember, never did really get back on her feet. It was very interesting because my tradition, you know, Diego, your godson's birthday was on the 9th, and that fell on a weekend. It was on Saturday. So our rule was he could go anywhere he wanted on the day of his birthday. And so he wanted to go to the Twin Towers on the 9th. And I convinced him, I said, you know, Diego, there's going to be so many people. It's a weekend. We'll go during the week, because I always let him take off his day of school. I said, so you pick a day next week, and it'll be your birthday day. And so he first said Tuesday, he wanted to go the 11th. It was going to be Tuesday. So we were going to go all the way up to the observation tower. We would have left early. And can't remember, Mateo was like, something happened. So I convinced Diego, okay, we'll go Thursday, I promise you. But that Tuesday was the day we were supposed to go. And because of, a few circumstances, we didn't. But, you know, that was our plan. So it was the most terrible thing to go through. And yet at the same time, it gave me the faith of what America's about. Because it didn't matter what anyone was. It didn't matter. First of all, you couldn't tell what race everyone was, because ash is a very strange color. It sticks to you, and it's you're all gray. It was amazing, and it didn't matter because we were all New Yorkers, and then we were all Americans. And the feeling I got was for weeks and weeks, and even months and months and years, that there was nothing that would be able, you know, to stop our spirit. The other thing that was amazing was, I used to go to St. Francis of Assisi right on 28th Street, 30th Street, down by the Madison Square Garden. And there was a father there, I've forgotten his name, but I went to a lot of his services, and he was the saint. Like, he looked over the firemen. They were a bunch of firemen. He was like the patron father. He would do all the services and that for them. And he went down and was killed by a falling people. They fell on him as he was giving the last rites to a fireman who had somebody fall on him, and he was dying. And as he was giving the last rites, that he was killed. And I remember them carrying him to the church, that little church down by Wall Street where, you know, I think George Washington went to, and they put him on the altar. And there were so many stories of people helping each other, and so many things that just people going beyond, you know, way beyond what they had to. And it just, you know, it was really a feeling that it just didn't matter. And for Gramercy Park is one of the few parks that is private. It's right down on, I would say it's like Gramercy and 20th Street, I guess. They open the gates. It's a beautiful little park, very small block, so that people could have a place to like just sit where there was greenery and stuff. Everyone brought food out, brought their tables out, brought chairs out. Even until the night, that same night, people brought candles, and they just wanted to be together. They didn't want to be in their apartments. They didn't want to be holed up watching TV. They really just wanted to make sure that, I guess, that we continued, that there was like a sense of us persevering, that nothing was getting us down, that we were together. And I remember saying to people that if I had to experience that, there'd be no other place I want to, maybe because of the diversity of New York. It just didn't matter. I mean, I probably would happen that way in any place in the United States, but New York seemed to be just very special in that way.
Well, you know, I think that you know this better than I do, but I think that's a mistake that people make about New Yorkers, you know, that they're cold and insensitive and self-centered. But the truth of the matter is that if I had to have somebody have in my back, I wouldn't. There's nobody I'd rather have than a group of New Yorkers. You know,
yes,
they really are special people, and you know, when you put that many people together in a small amount of space, there is a lot of hustle and bustle, and you know, what can come off as rude and insensitive behavior. But the truth of the matter is, if you need something from a New Yorker, you know, if you need something from somebody, you can't do better than to have a New Yorker have your back. They're not afraid.
They're not afraid of too much.
That's right. True. They're not afraid of too much. And, you know, this is just the perfect segue to tell people in America that my best friend, who was a New Yorker, when I was in L.A. and the police were lobbing tear gas in our direction, grabbed my ass and drug me across the street. And that's Kathleen Gomez, who said, you know, what's a little tear gas? Come on, let's go. So, yeah, there's very few things that New Yorkers are afraid of.
That's true.
And you know, they really are special people. But I've got to tell you that one thing that I found so disturbing, and thanks for that description, because there's no way to get a sense of what you went through compared to like what I went through, where I was sitting and watching the whole thing on TV. I mean, I had that sense of it all being surreal, you know, that this possibly couldn't be happening, but there wasn't anything beyond that. You know, everything we saw on TV, and the Pentagon was too far away. Those people that have been to Washington and know where the Pentagon sits in Arlington, Virginia, you know, they just shut down all the roads near the Pentagon. It's such a huge, I don't know if this is still true, but at one time it was the world's largest office building, and it's only 5 or 6 floors, I think. So it takes up just a gigantic amount of space. So they shut down everything around it. And so that was all isolated. We didn't have any sense of what you were going through with the people and the victims, and you know, all we saw is what we saw on TV.
There were a couple of things too. We lost in our firemen, you know, fire station. Yeah. Across from that was a park. It was just a block and a half from my apartment. So I would always take the boys there, and they were both big, you know, love the fire truck. What little boy doesn't? And I remember one time he fell off. I think it was Diego and Mateo, can't remember. And they had hurt themselves bleeding. But those guys were over, bandaged them up, put them up in the station. And I believe, and it was ladder 11, and I believe we lost about 12 guys from that fire station. And then other thing I will remember for this day is Rudy Giuliani going right down. He was down that day. I mean, they had him. He had been actually doing something down on World Street, and he went under, you know, where they wanted to protect him, and he ended up saying, no, I'm not going to stay down here. I'm going up. I'm going to be with New Yorkers, and he did. And, I mean, I think that was the other thing that brought us together. When your leader is there and he's not hiding out somewhere, you know, you feel like that's a politician. You know, I always had some issues. I had a lot of issues with Rudy Giuliani, but, man, when he did that, he really led us. And then I remember so well President Bush being in the air, and they were just, you know, I don't know where they were circling, but he was in an airplane somewhere because they didn't know what the heck was going on. And that, to me, I lost a lot of, you know, respect for him for running, because that's what it seems. You know, when your mayor's there and all these people have died, and one of the biggest cities in your country is under, you know, attack. Maybe someone would say, well, he had to, but he sure took a long time. I think it was 3 days, if I remember correctly, to come to New York City and see the people and what had happened. The other thing I remember, and this is going to be interesting, but I remember very well that, because what happened at this point with Diego and his group of peers, they were first grade, second grade, third grade, and they saw this. You know, some his friends, you know, people who lost their mom, lost their relatives, lost their friends. But there was never that grief counseling that they always say when a big catastrophe happens, well, you know, and we'll be providing, you know, doctors on the site to talk to people who need help, and we're going to bring that to the children. They never did. And for years afterwards, there were kids who, peers of Diego, who would not get in a taxi cab with anyone who had, you know, the headdress or looked like they were, you know, Muslim. There were parties a couple years after that of kids who burned the flag, you know, not of the American flag, but I can't remember what country they were, because they were Muslim and they, you know, they had this tie to this event. There was a big sense of, you know, like maybe what we went through when we were told to, remember, duck and hide underneath the seat.
Yeah.
You know, it's that same thing for them. And they, I mean, even till their teens, I know some that will just not get in a taxi, will not have anything to do with anyone who's Muslim. In one of the grades that my younger one went to school, a young girl came in, because, you know, New York public schools, you probably got 28 different cultures, you know, 32 different dialects. A little girl came from a Muslim country, and she wore, you know, the whole headdress, the covering, you know, I forget what not the veil, but she had the whole head and everything covered, and they were very cruel to her, and she ended up not being able to stay there, because there had never been any of that grief counseling, any of that, you know, talking it through for these kids, even though that had been promised. And I do remember very well the next day seeing, and people said it didn't happen, but it was on the news. I remember I saw it, I couldn't believe it, because my ex-husband had a business in Union City, and that's where they were showing, I don't know if it was Union City or Hoboken, but they had showed these videos of people clapping on the roof, excited, watching the towers burn in Brooklyn and over there, and the news had claimed that it was, you know, Muslims were cheering it, and I remember it very well. Because I saw the video, and then it just disappeared. You know, then it was like, well, no, they didn't. But the news at that point, the day after, had been very emphatic. They were all saying it, and then all of a sudden it just stopped. So when Donald Trump brought that up again, it was interesting to hear, like, it, you know, the media says, well, that never happened. I do remember it happening. I remember it was being talked a lot, even among my son and his friends. I mean, that was part of what got them so angry. And yet, it was like in their heads. If you ask Diego to this day, he remembers it. And yet, you know, nothing was ever done to talk it out, to get the anger out, and he still remembers it to this day. So, it's interesting.
Yeah, and you know, one thing I think is that you always, as terrible as something like this is, you always try to find a way to rationalize it. You know, that's just what we are as people. So you always want to strike out at somebody. There's always, you know, you don't want to feel like a victim. And if these guys were successful, they were most successful at making us all feel like victims, you know, that was really the thing. And you want, you know, it's like we do this all the time. We see that, you know, someone was just walking down the street and they were murdered. Well, they were in the wrong neighborhood, or they shouldn't have been out that late, or, you know, we always want to find a reason so that we can feel more comfortable, and we always want to find a way that we can resolve it in our own minds that this thing isn't going to happen to us, and that's really what I really want to talk about, is that I did some research on on how much violence, how much terrorism has gone on since 9/11, because I saw a poll that showed that more Americans are worried about terrorism today, the highest amount since 2013, and that 71% of people in June in a CNN poll said that they assume that there will be further terrorist attacks, and that one in four people rank terrorism as their top issue today in a poll that was done by NBC also a couple months ago. And so I started to look at how we've combated terrorism and what's actually happened since 9/11. And it's amazing. There really hasn't been a lot of terrorism in the United States since 9/11. Only 100 people have really been killed in terrorist attacks, and a third of them were killed in Orlando. And some of the terrorist attacks include things like the Beltway Sniper here in Washington that killed 17 people.
What about the Boston Marathon?
Boston Marathon, it includes Boston Marathon, it includes all those attacks. About 100 people have been killed since 9/11 in terrorist attacks domestically. Now, worldwide, we know that's not true worldwide.
But you know what I think it is, why it's so high and why people fear terrorism? Because it's people who aren't insane or are mad at their wife or hate black. It's people who don't like what we stand for. It's people who think that what our values are that we're, you know, evil. And it's a way of life that we've been brought up. I know I've been brought up to embrace that's under attack. And I think that terrorism is huger than just whether someone took a plane into the World Trade Center or put a bomb, you know, near the finish line. It's that whole, why would people want to do this to us who have given freedom to so many people and helped them in earthquakes and, you know, done so many things for so many people outside our country? How could they want to destroy what we represent? And I think that's what terrorism is to people. It's an attack on what we stand for in our way of life.
Well, you know, and I think you're right. I think that people just see it as totally unpredictable, you know,
right.
Whereas the other things you're talking about, domestic violence and other things, there's a way to understand that, maybe, even if it's kind of a perverse understanding, at least you can wrap your head around it. But this is just, you know, random, like the guy in Orlando or the guy that walks into a church and just shoots six or eight people in the back of the head. You know, there's no sense to it. The Boston Marathon, just, you know, that these people that were not doing anything to anybody, but out there trying to be healthy or do something for a cause, or, you know, and that anybody can be victimized. Children can be victimized, you know, adults. I think that old people, young people, I think that the unpredictability of it all, it makes me feel unsafe all the time. It's like, you know, you and I have dealt with politicians for many years, and we know, actually I went to an event yesterday that involved the Secret Service. You know, it's kind of like the Secret Service, they plan for every contingency, mm-hmm. but the one thing they can't plan for is that one nut, right? That one nut that's willing to, it's the one thing that they're like Hinckley, you know, it's funny or strange that to mention this, but Hinckley just got released the other day, and he's now living in Williamsburg, Virginia, the guy that tried to assassinate President Ronald Reagan. And you know, that unpredictability, I mean, that's the scariest thing out there, right? Is because you feel like on the other things, you know, You don't go down a dark alley by yourself, or you don't go out at certain times or certain places. But this, you could be sitting anywhere. You know, who would have thought to go to work that day? And also, it's so un-American, I think, to do what they did, to take a plane full of civilians and use it as a weapon. Right.
And I think maybe that's it, too, is that we don't know. We're not used to this kind of treachery in the sense that, you know, you take out the young, you take out the innocent because that's how you do it. And I think that's what scares us so much, too. When you, I was just watching, I can't remember what kind, if it was Syria or whatever, where a father made his 12-year-old son, and I think it was 14-year-old son, be, you know, human bombs. And the older brother went to where the father told him and, you know, blew himself up and killed a bunch of people. And this one little 12-year-old really didn't want to. And someone figured out that he was a suicide bomber and managed to grab his hand. The police came in. I mean, he was crying, but he was loaded. And his father had sent him out to kill innocent people. That's something we don't know how to deal with. We would never do that to our children. We would never, I mean, as crazy as sometimes we are as Americans, you know, I mean, we've had our serial killers like your sniper and all that. It's still not the same. It might be because it's a behavioral problem, a mental issue, or someone who just, you know, everything around him fell and he didn't get a break, and so he takes it out on people. But it was never a total aim at American way of life and what we stood for, like I think these terrorists are. Like the Orlando one, because, you know, they identify with, I guess it's a religion that basically sees us as Satan, as the evil people they need to kill to make this a better world. And we're not used to that. I mean, when the Japanese did Pearl Harbor, I don't think it was the same thing. I mean, it was power, it was war. But I don't necessarily, you know, they did it to a military ship, right? They didn't take out commerce. They didn't go, and I guess that was a big deal, that they took this Herdeset where they thought was our point, our weakest point was where money is made.
Well, you know, I mean, I think that we have the same type of religious extremists, but you're right, they don't act out that way. You know, I think, you know, we have examples of, you know, the wacky church in West Virginia where they go to veterans' funerals and say, God, but that's what they do. They go and they protest. They don't go and set off a bomb. They don't go, you know what I mean? They have the same kind of fundamentalist opinions, but the violence, I think that really perplexes most Americans when they think about the way these terrorists have handled things. But I've got to tell you that in doing my research, I found a lot of good news on the terrorist front. I was surprised, for example, that they estimate that with coalition forces in the Islamic State and our efforts in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Africa, Saudi Arabia, and in the Islamic State, that since 9/11, we've killed as many as 89,000 terrorists. 89,000.
You know what? That doesn't give me comfort. You know why? Because, of course, after 2001. I left New York in 2007. I went back to Arizona because I got a divorce. And while I was down there for 7 years, I saw, remember we've talked about this, Russians, Afghanistans, Iranians, Pakistanians, I mean, from all over, coming across, leaving ISIS material. You know, we've had one of the ranchers that spoke to you, you know, where he finds the Quran and ISIS material and the praying rugs. They say that Russians have come across and taken a lot of these little mini cartels, taken over them in Mexico, and are supplying the cartel with weapons. I mean, it all sounds great when it's over there, but I think of Americans even had a clue on what is coming through you saw the borders down there. It's open. I mean, there are ways to control it without building a wall, but we don't understand that it's not the Mexicans. It's not necessarily the Latins. It's everyone else who comes over. My father was just telling me how the other day he saw a man walking down the street. And he looked, he thought he was Latin, you know, Mediterranean looking Mexican, whatever. And he was speaking to him because usually, you know, my dad is very compassionate. We've seen all, you know, we've seen people come over who are really just looking to be able to feed themselves and their family. And we've seen those who are here for the wrong reasons. But he, you know, you have to feel for these people, right? They're lost. He was looking around. So he started speaking to him in Spanish. And later, as they were talking, realized this guy did not know any Spanish. He was speaking, my dad said, some, you know, a language. It wasn't European language. He thought it was of some Arabic language he didn't know. And he then went in and called the Border Patrol, and I don't know if they found him or not. That's happening all the time. And when you have the Russians involved in your cartel fights across from Douglas, you know, and winning, the cartel that they're backing wins the area, there are other things that are happening that, and a lot of these people, they're not here because they love America. It's, they're here to infiltrate it. I mean, I know it sounds conspiratorial, but, you know, call up anybody who lives on the border, the ranchers. I think maybe you should have Mr. Kimball back on because, you know, he talked to you about the raping trees and he talked to you about what was coming over and that it's not just people who are Latin Americans looking for jobs. It's people that are coming who are not our friends.
Well, I can understand that sentiment. And I say again, it's my opinion that, you know, what these guys did on 9/11 was create a feeling where all Americans felt unsafe, and that was really the victory for them beyond the several thousand people that they killed. But when you look at the fact that we've only had 37 attacks in America in since 2001, which are classified as terrorists, only 23 of them have resulted in deaths. 100 people in 15 years. That's about 7 people a year. In the United States, 91 people die every day from gun violence.
Well,
that's every day. So it seems to me that when you're losing 91 people a day as opposed to 100 people in 15 years, you know, you're focusing on the wrong thing.
It seems to me that you're just willing to accept the facts that are out there put on the internet by government agencies. Again, I know I sound like a conspiratorial, but I think it would be alarming to find out all the ones that they've caught, the ones that they've been maybe able to somehow not be able to go through. I think there's a lot of a very intricate operation of people coming into the United States who are not here to do good, and they don't want to tell us because it would terrify us. I mean, you know, statistics are one thing, but it's different when you sit there in a town and you see, hey, you know what? They're saying that there's not very many people crossing over. Well, you know, in 1 month, and this was about 2011, no, it was 11, yeah, there was 8,000 people caught going across Douglas's border, three-mile radius in town, you know, the city limits. And for everyone you catch, 10 get by. Now, granted, I think with the drones and with some of these fences up, it's caused it to go down. But, you know, when they're catching people who are rapists, I mean, there was just something on the news today from Tucson, how they caught a serial rapist from, and he was from Eastern Europe. The other thing, too, is it's interesting because today, 1:30, down at Walmart, in a pretty nice area of Kansas City, a woman was getting in and putting her infant into the car. Two guys come up, hitting her on the head. I don't know if they wanted to take her car or what, or they wanted to kill her for some reason. They hit her head with their guns. She was bleeding. I guess she screamed. A good Samaritan came to her aid. The two guys who were attacking her turned, shot him. A third Good Samaritan pulled out his weapon and shot one of the suspects, killed him and wounded the other. And they say that that third Samaritan who had his gun saved some a lot of lives because these guys were just shooting everyone. And I don't think that the woman that they hit or that they beat and the man that they shot have not died. They're in critical condition. But they're saying if it hadn't been for that third Samaritan, there would have been a lot more deaths. So it's going to be interesting how you deal with when you talk to people. I mean, a lot of people out here carry a gun, and this is what they say. There's just too many freaking bad people that have guns. And in Kansas City, I mean, there are shootings every day, and it's the bad guys who've got the gun who are killing innocent people in their houses. It's drive-by shootings. We've had, I can't even remember how much it is. It's over 100 or so. Well, I shouldn't say. There's quite a few since I've been here.
Well, but you're talking about three people that were saved today, and I will tell you that 91 people will die today from gun violence. So, I mean, I'm not saying that, and I think most Americans agree that what we want to do is we want to keep guns out of the hands of crazy people. You know, it doesn't bother me that good, upstanding, law-abiding people can carry a gun. It doesn't bother me that there are things like carry permits. I think that it's fine if you you have no criminal record or you're not you have no record of mental instability that you can get a weapon to protect yourself. I think it's fine to have a weapon in your home to protect yourself if that's what you want. But this craziness that we have in this country about having automatic weapons and clips that can take out 50 people in a matter of 3 minutes and all this other stuff, this has to stop. And things like background checks and other things have to be enforced.
So
and you and I know that a lot of these guys, you know that a lot of these guys that have automatic weapons are not out there trying to protect themselves from bad guys. What they're trying to do is protect themselves from the government. And to have these paranoid people out there with automatic weapons is just, it's crazy.
Well, I'm telling you something. I'm glad I don't have a gun because, you know, how I've been talking about health insurance and how I have to pay $500. I'm working a part-time job. It's a seasonal job here in Kansas City. But because my residency is Arizona, I can't go to a doctor in Kansas City. I can't get my blood pressure. I go online to see what the penalty would be if I just didn't pay. And I told you this, page after page of citizens who are saying how this is drowning them. I'm fed up with the government. I'm fed up with the establishment. I'm fed up with the politicians in Congress. They've done nothing but make things worse, whether it's education, whether it's health care. What they've done is just unbelievable. I can't stomach it anymore. And maybe it's being out here in the rural areas, in Kansas isn't, but where I was in Arizona, going to North Dakota, traveling to New Mexico, and now here out in Kansas, you know, I don't know what water they serve or they drink in D.C., but these guys, when they go there, they sure forget why they were sent there. And I understand why people are so angry. And
Well, me too. And
I think what Hillary's comment was just terrible. I mean, what you need to do is figure out why these people are so angry. Why do they – haters? Yeah, they hate the establishment. And that's whatever it may be, Republican or Democrat, white, green, or gold, or purple, pink people. It doesn't matter. If you work for the establishment and you have your kids are lobbyists and you're in a 1 million mansion and you're the people out here in your district are trying to get by and they can't because the insurance costs we now have to pay is drowning us, you know, I mean, she needs to wake up.
I want to keep guns out of the hands of people like you.
Well, you better because
and
I'm
wants
serious.
To go out and shoot people. But no, I agree with you. I think that that's just too easy and cavalier to say people are haters. If people are haters, there are haters in the world. I think that there's a modicum, certainly, of truth in what she had to say. But she shouldn't say it because it's our obligation as politicians to figure out why people feel the way they do because they all get a vote. Everybody gets a vote. And I understand that. Look, Donald Trump would not be doing as well as he is doing if people weren't dissatisfied. People
are not dissatisfied. They're angry.
They're just right. They're
not
angry. Absolutely. Right.
They're
angry. No. Angry is a much better way to put it. They are. They're angry. This is the get. That's what I said about Trump. He's the get even candidate. This is the guy that, you know, in terms of politics, if, you know, somebody steals your parking space at the mall, this is not a guy that's going to leave an angry note. This is a guy that's going to key the car. And that's what you want to do. You want to get even. You want to say, oh, you know what? I'm sick and tired of being pushed around. I'm sick and tired
of being pushed around. What people are seeing is not just being pushed around. It's not having any money to pay the bills at the end of the month. It's not having enough money to make the bills, to pay for your kid to go to college, to give them health insurance. That those two things drown you as a family. And I mean, it's just atrocious. I don't know how we can be strong if we're so weak within, and if we can't even feed our people and educate our people and give them a job. Who are we to go and save anybody else?
Well, we all have to get to this subject. We're running out of time, but this is a subject for another show, and I think you're absolutely right, except that we're hating the wrong people, not all the wrong people, because politicians are certainly to blame for this. But you know what? People, billionaires, to take advantage of all of us, as I've said to you before, it's not Mexicans sneaking over the border stealing the jobs from General Motors. It's General Motors sending the jobs to Mexico.
It's the government, the people in Congress who haven't dealt with the tax breaks that these guys do. To be able to do this, there's this break in our tax system that allows them to go to Ireland and not pay any taxes. We have got to fix it, and they don't have the guts to do it. And that's what pisses me off. You've got these conservatives who only want it because they couldn't get not-for-profit status, who want to impeach the IRS commissioner, and at the same time, they've decreased the budget for IRS, when if anything, it shows we need to have money to be able to the hackers not be able to get your information. That is only going to rise next year. So this is what gets people angry, that these guys go there and something happens. It becomes about them. It becomes about their ideology, their agenda, and they forget why they were being put in that place. And then they sit there, instead of having some common sense and realizing this is the wrong thing to do, they haven't due process, they've done it the wrong way, the whole thing, instead of realizing that, they're going to spend our taxpayers' money to try to keep anything from going through. I'm sorry, everyone should just be out, and I really do. When I heard a Republican say to me, a staunch Republican lobbyist say, I'm going to vote for Hillary because at least I know the system will remain the same. I'm sorry, right there is exactly what's wrong with everything in Washington.
Well, on that note, we're going to end, but I'm going to say we're a democracy. If we don't like our politicians, we should replace them. So in the end, it's not the politicians any more to blame than it is for us for sending these guys back time and time again. But before I thank my guest, I'd like to say the one politician this week that we love here in Washington is Senator Brian Schatz, Democrat of Hawaii, who signed on to our statehood bill, bringing us up to 20 people that think in the Senate to think that the people of the District of Columbia should be equal. So thank you, Senator. We appreciate your support. Thank you, Kathleen. We appreciate your outrage. We'll see you all next week, and we're going to play you out with a song that I love, and
I should have requested a song.
Does.
It's not Kumbaya, is it?
Boogie and the Booty Men for you. No, it's Lee Greenwood with God Bless the USA.
There you go.
Let's all remember the brave firemen and policemen of New York today.
And its citizens.
Thanks, America. And the citizens. See you next week.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife. I thank my lucky stars to be living here.
the flag still stands.